On the 28th of May, South Africans woke up to a Sunday Times headline that read, "Exposed. Explosive Gupta emails at the heart of state capture." It was a political bombshell. In nuclear terms, it was the fat man. Hundreds of thousands of emails and documents showed how the Gupta family made billions leveraging powerful political connections. These emails have reinforced the feeling that South Africa's institutions have been compromised and its leaders corrupted. Is this the smoking gun that shows how one family have captured a country? And how will it all end? Welcome to the first episode of Stolen, the podcast that takes a behind-the-scenes look at the ongoing story of state capture. In this episode, we speak to the Sunday Times' deputy editor, Stembiso Msomi, and Andrew Trench from The Times, who have been flexing their editorial muscles in a bid to flush out the truth. These are the people who are helping us connect the dots. How did it all come together?
It started out as a story about a letter. So what we got was that letter that President Zuma purportedly wrote to the UAE. And it was just that one letter. And it comes to us, we are approaching deadline, and you're already looking at what is the story for Sunday. And then you get someone giving you this, and you're thinking, this can't be true. And it is unsigned. And I mean, we had a very big debate in our office because we thought it was not authentic. And then we decided, no, let's go back to the people who came with us to see where do they get it from. But some of the details in the letter suggested that this is not totally out of it. But I'd had an experience several years before, for instance, with the so-called fake emails, I think 2006, 2007, when Zuma and Mbeki were fighting. So I was personally very suspicious because I was thinking we're going back to that era where people come up with emails just ahead of an ANC conference.
Yes, I mean, we are right in the middle of that fake news era.
Yes.
So, but you were convinced. What convinced you?
So what happened is that then colleagues went back to the initial sources, and then they came up with other emails to say, look, this letter that we're giving to you comes from these emails that say 1, 2, 3, and you look at some of them, and luckily some of them refer to the correspondence that had happened between the Sunday Times and the Guptas, so you could tell that this is a genuine email. And also the email addresses, for instance, Duduzane Zuma used a Gmail account, and the Gmail account was not generally known by people. And that Gmail account was actually genuine. It's something that when we corresponded with him, that's the same email address that we used.
So the story that you're talking about was the house in Dubai.
Well, it started as going to be about the house in Dubai, but when we started seeing the other emails, we then decided, no, actually, we want to do a much broader story than that. So that first story was talking about these emails that were revealing what the ministers were doing. So we had to work very quickly to cover all those stories because we also checked the dates. So you see that the emails are talking about ministers who has trips to Europe, for instance. And then you look at the stories that we've covered, and the dates did correspond. So that gave us confidence that what we were working on was genuine.
So did you have a sleepless night?
Yes, of course. On Friday, it was much better. Whilst we were still going to be debating the stories, it was after publication that you're waiting for Sunday and you're thinking, maybe there's something that I missed and there is going to be a huge comeback and I'll be in trouble.
So, Andrew, that was the mini leak. Tell us where you came in and how you discovered all of this.
Well, I mean, first I knew about this sort of Gupta email leaks was on Sunday when I saw the Sunday Times, and immediately I was on the blower to Bongani Sikoka, the Sunday Times editor, and said, you know, Bongus, what the hell? I mean, this is like the most like astounding story we've ever come across. And I mean, Bung, and I was chatting to him about saying, look, we have to start reporting whatever's like still in play, you know, on this, you know, for our digital platforms and into the daily into the daily paper, the Times, you know, which he was great about, and the guys were had already done a hell of a lot of work that was ready to roll. But at that point, we didn't really know that there was like this mother load. And then, I mean, there were some interactions during the day, myself and a couple of colleagues, and we picked up that there was actually something much bigger that was available, and that there was like a very strong chance that we would be able to lay our hands on it. But again, I mean, we had no real sense of the scope of it. I mean, one of the people that I was dealing with was suggesting that there was something in the region of about 400 gigabytes of material, which to me just sounded so like unbelievable. I mean, I didn't really kind of take it seriously. But you know, I mean, over the course of the next 24 hours, we realized that this was probably for real. But there was no sense of whether what had already been sort of handed to the Sunday Times and I think City Press also managed to get a sliver of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that was the best of it,
yeah.
And if, you know, maybe like the rest of it would be sort of like, you know, junk mail to, you know, some Gupta email address and nothing of any other value. You know?
But I mean, it's so much, it's overwhelming. How do you start investigating? How do you start poring over these emails? How do you even begin to search? Is it a kind of a fishing expedition where you just throw a line and see who you catch?
Yeah.
Pretty much it is. I mean, you put in people's names
so
and
it's
check
control
and trying to check if anything comes up. I remember how frustrating it was that first weekend because, of course, the people who would have had this thing before us would have particular interest in what kind of stories they would like to see going into the paper. And we then decide, no, actually, we want to do a broader thing. We don't just want to do a story about Zuma writing a letter to Dubai to say he wants to live there when he retires. We want to do much broader than that. But then you have all these names of people that have been linked to the Guptas in one way or the other. You want to check all of them at the same time, and it is impossible. And you don't know what story you're going to get. And then late in the afternoon, I remember that Saturday, we then get a tip-off from someone in the presidency to say, you guys are saying you're working on the story, and you're saying to us, this is exclusive to you. Yet we have this set of questions that are coming from your rival newspaper. And they seem to be coming from the same kind of information that you are working on. And then you then get worried as to how do you make your story better than that of the opposition. And you have to work against time.
Yeah, and I think the crazy time, I think, was the first 2 weeks. Mm. Because, I mean, certainly in the first couple of days, I mean, we had no, I mean, we knew there'd been this initial leak of a couple of hundred emails that City Press and the Sunday Times had. And then we got, you know, the sort of mother load. And I mean, we kind of figured at the time that, I mean, we had this sort of suggestion that there was someone in Europe that had it, and that there was some sort of possible sort of Panama Papers type player that might be on the go. And Bongani actually reached out to the people on that side, and we heard nothing from them. When we heard nothing from them, I said to Bongani, there's definitely someone else here that's got it. But I mean, we had our suspicions, but there was no sign. What was weird was that on that Monday, I mean, if anyone else had had it, we thought they would have been kind of running with it and starting to break it. But we kind of figured then, well, if someone else has got it, maybe they've also kind of got the same problems that we've got, that the enormity of the material is like so daunting that they might still be going through it. So what we did is like put together a team, I think initially around probably 8 or 9 reporters, locked them up in a conference room on the fourth floor, which we kind of laughingly called the Colbert Fair Room after Trump's tweet, I think.
Mistweet, yeah.
And we basically just said to the guys, let's just write as much as we can. Because, you know, if someone else does have it and start to break it, you know, at least we've kind of like, you know, made some inroads in the material. But I mean, as Demisa was saying, I mean, initially the material was so huge, I mean, that it took, I think, like 18 hours for us to make a single copy of the one disc that we were given. At the same time, while we were trying to actually work off it, you know, so yeah, you're kind of sitting there and sort of like looking at everything that's been written about the Guptas over the years preceding, and then like, you know, randomly kind of throwing in those names and whatnot to see what comes up.
So
and then finding material and then going like, okay, that's fantastic. Now, like, put that to your side and let's find another one. So it's already sort of like kind of controlled and barely managed panic, I think, for at least the first like 5 days.
And now, is there an editorial strategy that's kind of panning out?
Yes, generally you have that team that's working on the stories, and I think now we found our rhythm, and you know exactly what sorts of stories you're looking for. So it's much better. Yes, now and again you'll come across a story that you never even thought about. And I think that as time goes on anyway, we are going to, because I think what's going to happen is that there would be more people confirming what had happened, but they will come up with even more information to support what was happening with the Guptas. Because one of the things that I found strange is that you don't get a response from the presidency anymore on the stories. The Guptas are just not reacting at all. I mean, yesterday was the first time that Atul comes out to say these are fake emails or whatever he said. Yeah. But they decided that they're just going to kill the story by not saying anything. But every other person you go to, even if they are very loyal to Zuma, like Zuma's own advisor, you go to her, you say, you wrote these emails, they'd rather try and explain than to deny them. So which tells me that if there is an investigation that's going to happen beyond what we are exposing as newspapers, there would be much more detail that will come out of this.
At Journ School, young journalists are taught to ask questions about the whistleblower's agenda. What do you think the agenda is of the person or people behind this leak?
I mean, that's a complicated question. I mean, we obviously have knowledge of, you know, who was the whistleblower.
That was my next question.
Yeah, which we never will
no, of course,
disclose. No. But I think the agendas are complex. You know, I mean, I don't think that. I think one of the agendas I think is a sense of like trying to sort of set things right. But I think there's also, as often with every whistleblower, I mean, there's a lot of self-interest, you know, in their actions. I think certainly some of the people involved around the leak, I mean, without a doubt, I mean, there's an agenda that they hope to see a change, you know, I mean, and to me, so, I mean, tell me if you disagree that, I mean, you know, people do want to see action, you know, and I think, I mean, journalistically, you need to be kind of aware of what some of those agendas might be, and also be aware that, I mean, consequentially, like the reporting that you do, because of the truth of it, you know, might actually service that agenda, but it's not to be kind of acting in concert with an agenda, but being aware that it's there. Yeah.
And for us, really, our agenda is to just put the story out there, you're exposing corruption, so whoever may be having their own agenda, we're not playing into that. So, for instance, I saw someone was criticizing us, for instance, with the initial story that we were trying to influence the outcome of the ANC. I think it was an NEC meeting which was supposed to recall Zuma. There was no way we could have considered that because the story was going to come out on a Sunday. The discussions in the ANC had been happening on a Friday and Saturday. If we wanted to influence that, we would have decided to just go with the story on Friday night or Saturday morning online and say, okay, it has to be out there so that everyone picks it up. And, I mean, how do you guarantee that in a closed political party meeting on a Sunday morning, people will start by talking about what is in the newspapers rather than what they have on their agenda. Yeah. So for us, that was not a consideration at all. I saw that there were people who were trying to say that is what we were trying to do. And I hope that since then, we've been writing stories almost every day, actually, that shows that we didn't have a political agenda behind what we are doing other than just to do our job as journalists.
Will the identities be revealed ever?
I mean, not by us.
No. Will we get to
that? I think the Guptas must certainly know who it is. Mm. I mean, there's such a volume of reporting that has come out and so many references to correspondence that, I mean, it doesn't take the work of a rocket scientist for them to connect their own dots. Yeah. So I suspect that they do know who the whistleblower is, or certainly where the material emanates from. I'm personally kind of surprised, actually, that there hasn't been an attempt to denigrate and attack, the potential source of it as part of a defense. But I think it's just that the evidence, I mean, and the material is so overwhelming. I mean, despite the spin that's going down in London at the moment, you know, that I don't even think that that works. I mean, it's like the volume of it is so great that to try and discredit, you know, essentially like 200,000 pieces of correspondence, I mean, it's impossible. You know, I mean, no matter how many times you say it, you know, the average person is not stupid and, you know, kind of gets that this material is legit and was for real. But I mean, you know, so I would have thought that, like, that would have been a natural vector of attack, because to try and sort of, like, denigrate, you know, sort of attack motives and individuals, you know.
You know,
I'm
kind
of surprised. Maybe it's because Bob Possinger was fired or anything.
Yeah. But I think there was an attempt in the first few weeks. We started in political circles, we started getting stories at foreign agencies, specifically the Americans, so the Israelis were behind this. No, it's created by someone sitting somewhere in Johannesburg. It's this or that political camp within the ANC. But I think over time they realized that most people just don't believe that nonsense. So they then stopped and then thought maybe the story will just die its natural death.
The email trove accelerated the story. Where would we have been in covering the story without it? I mean, would we have got to where we are eventually, or?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, there's a limit to what, like, journalists can actually do legally. Mm. You know, and I mean, I think in some ways barring, you know, a couple of sort of like avenues that might have like opened things up. I mean, things were really kind of like now in the hands of sort of like institutions, like the public protector and whatnot, you know. And I mean, it was kind of hard to see. I mean, barring like, you know, the sort of action that Tuli Madonsela had asked for in the state of capture report actually being sort of actioned, you know. I mean, you know, there was no other kind of like low hanging fruit sort of obviously sitting around, you know. Mm. So, you know, and we all have our, you know, criticism and commentary on the effectiveness of law enforcement at the moment. So, but I think it would have hit a wall for at least a couple of years until there'd been kind of significant like political change. So, yeah, I mean, this was a kind of gift to journalism. And in terms of like the corroboration that it's like provided for stories that have like run over the previous years, but also the things that it's fleshed out that we'd never really understood or never would have imagined the scale of in our wildest sort of journalistic dreams.
You know. I mean, you look at Eskom, for instance, all the stories, I mean, when the public protector's report came out, they were still denying that all those things were happening. But now with the details and the emails, you see people being suspended. You see Parliament now acting because there is some evidence that is tangible. So I don't even think that the Commission of Inquiry that even the president has been talking about is something that they plan to do, that it was going to achieve much without this kind of information. So I think now you can't play with the terms of reference because you will have to refer to what is in the emails, which will make an impact.
Every day there's a new story, a new Gupta story. Are we in danger of readers becoming sick of the story? In other words, will we reach peak leak? And how do you make sure that the story is fresh?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a huge danger. You know, it's like, and hard to deal with that because, I mean, there's almost like an obligation. I mean, you know, from a sort of like public interest point of view, to kind of put this stuff out there and create the record of it, you know, because it needs to be known for, you know, whether it's like for selling newspapers today or for the history books tomorrow. I mean, I think that's, there's a duty that is not entirely bound to whether like readers are necessarily have a fulsome appetite for it anymore. So, I mean, that's the one thing. But I mean, I think the other thing, the challenge is here, is also kind of to keep like developing the narrative on this thing so that people understand that even though like the additional sort of like stories that are coming out are actually kind of like, you know, enriching our understanding of what's been happening in the country. And I think in the early days of this, of reporting, this was easy because everything was revelatory and sort of scandalous. And I mean, now we have to kind of think in a more sophisticated way about how we put these together. So I think we've kind of like gone into sort of stage two of telling the story where it's not so much here's an email that shows X, Y. There's more consideration given, I think, to kind of like collecting up the
and
themes.
And how
of
things linked to each other.
Yeah, and more sort of explanatory like journalism out of it. And I mean, I think you asked this question earlier about, you know, like the overwhelming kind of size of it and how you sort of wrap your head around it. And I think, I mean, part of wrapping your head around it is working with this material for a couple of months. And what you start to do is kind of helicopter up
Yeah.
So you can kind of start to see it from a distance now, and you kind of see the shape of this like organized network, which I think in itself is a really fascinating story. And I think that's what we probably need to do some more work on now is sort of like taking readers up a couple of levels to sort of like look at it a little bit further from afar, so they can sort of see the sort of kingdom for what it is, rather than wandering through the streets, you know. So I think we'll probably be doing more of that. But I mean, I think that said, I mean, there's still a hell of a lot of revelatory stuff to come.
Yeah.
The rolling Gupta email stories have caused massive ripples. They've revealed how multi-billion rand deals keep the state capture going, and with the help of civil servants, execs in state-owned companies, and high-placed politicians and cabinet members, have shown how the Gupta family has been enriched courtesy of the South African taxpayer. So two questions. How are the Guptas trying to spin their way out of this?
What surprises me right now is that they are not trying, because initially they had said they would take legal action against newspapers. They're not even trying with like minor stories to take any action. It's like they are afraid that if it goes to court, more will be revealed. So they are not even trying, which is very fascinating.
Andrew, what has surprised you by this whole saga?
Well, I mean, I think partly that, you know, because I mean, I was like bracing myself for some serious kind of like spin back and backlash on it. And I mean, we were talking about it the other day, and I mean, I think out of probably north of 85, 90 stories that we've produced, I mean, I'm dealing with one case at the Press Ombudsman on a minor technical complaint. So, I mean, you know, I mean, if this material was fake, I mean, we would be sitting with the most epic kind of like avalanche of defamation lawsuits that ever to be confronted as a media organization. And there has not been a lawyer's letter or a peep, you know. I mean, that surprises me. And I sort of kind of, I keep waiting for the sort of, for what I'm not seeing coming to sort of roar around the corner and kind of flatten us, you know. So, I mean, that surprises me hugely. But I mean, I think the other thing that surprises me incredibly is like, I mean, because it really gives us, I think, an insight into like really how this kind of this sort of like a sense of accountability and consequence has been eroded in a constitutional democracy. I mean, in other constitutional democracies, I mean, the revelations that have been made about public office bearers, I mean, a fraction of that would have led to, you know, dismissals from cabinets, prosecutions, etc. I mean, I think for me that's the real crisis, is that, you know, that this kind of material can be put out there, and this like wholesale capture of the state can be explained with all the sort of crookedness and corruptness that's involved in it, and for there to be no like overt action politically or from a kind of criminal prosecution point of view is absolutely astounding to me.
How do you think this is going to end, Stempiso?
Well, I think at some stage there will be prosecutions. You just don't know whether now or maybe in 2 years' time when Zuma leaves office, or if he leaves the office in January, or if he leaves the office next Thursday. It just depends on the politics of it. But what I found encouraging is that we've moved beyond generally from a point where there were people who were denying that there was state capture to an acceptance even amongst people who support Zuma that this is a problem. But now everyone is trying to find out how do we come out of it without maybe them being prosecuted or the people they support being prosecuted. But I think because we've moved beyond that, it means that at some stage, someone will have to take action. I know right now the state institutions that are supposed to be doing that are weakened, but I don't think they will be weakened forever. I think if maybe we had a new government post elections or whenever, then that government would be forced to take some action. If they are not acting just against the Guptas, they will have to act against government officials and ministers.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think, I mean, in fact, I wrote an editorial about it today. I mean, so even though my depression of like my previous comment about, you know, like the sense of accountability, what we are seeing now, I think, is like the silver lining, is that there are like these little shoots of hope that that things are happening. And I think what's interesting as well, and I mean, I think that we kind of come out of this with a sort of sharper sense of values, you know, because what you're seeing is like other actors in society, like realizing that they can be consequential, you know, that if the state won't act, others can. I mean, if you see like the down to like the Development Bank of South Africa forcing like a move on Eskom, And I think that's really healthy. I mean, because it, like, it's showing us that, like, in this democracy, that there are many other people that can pull the strings besides the political actors. So I think it kind of, like, ends like that, you know, that, you know, there's definitely a political consequence that we can't still really map out. But society, I think more generally, is kind of has been improved by it and by the things that we see people starting to do.
You've been listening to Stolen, the podcast taking you behind the scenes of our coverage of the revealed Gupta emails and state capture. This production is brought to you by Multimedia Live in collaboration with Sunday Times and The Times, and your anchor is Jonathan Anser. We'd like to thank the editors Andrew Trench, Stambisa Masomi, and the journalists Graham Hoskin, Sabelo Skitty, Genevieve Quintal, Kyle Cowan, and Mzilikazi Wa Africa. I'm your producer, Scott Peter Smith. Thanks for listening.